Please be seated. Well, good morning. We have lots of new faces in our courtroom today. My notes tell me that we have a group from Marathon Baptist Academy. If that's correct, would they please stand? Very good. Thank you very much. And also, I have a note, but I don't know if this is the same group or a different group. Marshall, Watertown, Dodge, Jefferson County, Wisconsin. It doesn't say a particular. That's the county you all are from. Okay, good. Well, I have the notes, but not always understand them. The students are here on a program we operate in conjunction with the State Bar called Court with Class, so they'll know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us today. If you can remain after our second argument this morning, students, Justice Brian Hagedorn, who's right down there at the end of the bench, will come down and chat with you a little bit and tell you a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court. He won't talk about the substance of the case that we're going to hear now, but I think he'll have a lot of interesting things to say. So if you have the time, please do stay, and anybody else that's here certainly are all welcome to hear Justice Hagedorn. With that little bit of business out of the way, are you ready to proceed, counsel?
Yeah.
Okay, then I will call our first case of the day, Washington County versus C.S.
Winnebago. Winnebago.
I'm sorry, Winnebago County. Thank you very much. I'm having trouble reading this morning.
Are you sensitive to that?
I just noticed. I don't know why.
Well, it's nice to have the correct name when you call the case. Otherwise, a little bit of a bother for nothing, right? Anyway, if you are ready to proceed,
good
please
morning.
Do.
Good Thank morning. You. May it please the court. My name is Caitlin Lamb, and I represent CS. Prisoners have a significant liberty interest in avoiding the unwanted administration of medication. The forcible injection of medication into a non-consenting person's body represents a substantial interference with that person's liberty. Medication can have serious, even fatal side effects. Side effects may include involuntary body spasms, inability to sit still, and neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which can lead to cardiac dysfunction and death. So this case involves the state's ability to overcome a prisoner's right to refuse medication. At issue is whether the medication statute 5161-1G is unconstitutional because it allows for the involuntary administration to prisoners without a finding of dangerousness at any point.
Counsel, I just want to make sure that I kind of zero in and precisely kind of understand your argument. Some of the cases talk about different interests here and there. What I read your argument to be is relatively focused and narrow, which is dangerousness is required. And because it's not under the statute for these prisoners, that it's unconstitutional. Is that true? Is that kind of where you're resting your argument? Are you making other arguments beyond that? For example, if we found dangerousness, let me ask it another way. If we found dangerousness is not required, can you still win?
So, first of all, I would say my argument is focused on the absence of the dangerousness requirement. But even if dangerousness is not required, I still think that there is something more that is needed in terms of involuntarily committing, and then, well, the focus is on involuntary medicating a prisoner. And so I just think that the statute, the way it is, it's lacking. And the reason that I think that dangerousness in particular is so important, because it provides that, like, individualized link to the person.
Counsel, what are we to do with some of the cases, Wood, for example, where we've made clear that in reading all these same cases that dangerousness is not required necessarily?
So Your Honor, if I heard you correctly, did you just reference the State versus Wood
yes.
case? So that case, I think, is different in a couple of respects. So first of all, in Wood, we're talking about somebody who's been found not guilty by reason of mental insanity. So we have an NGI proceeding. And so I think that case is distinguishable just because in that instance, the person has committed a crime because of the mental illness. There's that additional link. And I think that if you look at the language of Wood, Wood itself actually even distinguishes NGIs from a prisoner. So when you're talking about NGI, there's still like an underlining or implicit finding of dangerousness. Here, we don't have any connection between a criminal conviction and the mental illness. And so I do think Wood is distinguishable in that effect. I'd also note, I found it interesting when I was preparing for this argument that in Wood, I believe that the individual actually also found incompetent. And I don't read the court to be holding, focusing solely on incompetency as a finding allowing for the administration of involuntary medication. And so I think that the prisoners, you know, without that additional requirement that connects it to the individual, which I think should be dangerousness, I don't think that there's enough to administer the medication
Counsel,
against their will.
If dangerousness is, if we were to find that this is not required, you said that there still need to be something else. What would that something else be, and what is the source of the requirement for that something else?
Well, I think there needs to be some additional individual's finding. And the reason I say that is because I'm using the word dangerousness really broadly. I think dangerousness can take any, you know, can take a lot of different forms. It can be harm to, it can be harm to oneself. It can be harm to others. I mean, there just needs to be something more that actually connects as to why it's enough to administer medication to a person against their will.
So give me an example of what that might look like. If it's not dangerousness, sure. what would be acceptable?
I mean, maybe a more passive type of harm occurring. Because I view, the way I interpret dangerousness is the physical harm. A harm to the person or a harm to their self. You know, the person might end up committing some type of suicide. Or perhaps the person's going to end up attacking their cellmate or somebody else. And so I view it more focused on the physical, but maybe there just needs to even be something more, some type of deterioration or disability. I think that just finding that the person's mentally ill and that they're incompetent, I just think that the statute's unconstitutional. And in terms of that, I don't want to resolve like what dangerousness might take or the form it might take in the context of this particular argument. I do think that is something that's up to the legislature to decide what's sufficient. So my real point in this case is
if it's up to the legislature, perhaps they've already decided. Maybe they've decided that dangerousness is not required and that all that is required is that the person is incarcerated.
And, Your Honor, I do not think that is enough just to say, based on the fact of incarceration, that that would be enough to administer medication to somebody against their will. Just because of, I think everyone is in agreement that the case law says that you have a substantial liberty to avoid the administration of medication because it's such an intrusion into your body. It results in all of these terrible side effects, death, can result in involuntary muscle spasms. And
all of that may be true, but that means that we can't rely on what the legislature has decided. Because the legislature apparently has decided that you can do an involuntary medication order without a finding of dangerousness. So you're saying we cannot rely on what the legislature has decided.
That's true, yes, Your Honor.
Can you put this in the rubric of the 14th Amendment? Because what I hear you saying is the legislature made a decision. We're here today to make you're asking the court today to render its decision about whether what the legislature decided satisfies the 14th Amendment. So can you frame what you're saying in that context? Because that's how your brief seems to read.
Yes. I would say that the statute is unconstitutional because there wasn't the finding of dangerousness. And I think that if you look at Washington versus Harper, the language is very clear in there. We hold that given the requirements of the prison environment, the due process clause permits the state to treat a prison inmate who has a serious mental illness with antipsychotic drugs against his will.
But counsel, in that case, the policy that the court was dealing with itself required dangerousness. So it wasn't really quite so comparable as a lot of the arguments in your brief, because what we're looking at here is a policy here. It's a statute, constitutional when it doesn't require dangerousness. But that one, they were interpreting. They didn't have the same question before it, because the actual policy in that case did require dangerousness.
Yes, that is correct. And the reason, though, that I think that requirement is, as I was saying before, I just don't think it's enough based on the fact that somebody is mentally ill and that they're found incompetent to be able to administer the medication. I mean, that means that anyone who's mentally ill or incompetent. And I think dangerousness, it's so important because it adds that individual characteristic, because it says...
Well, you know, even in Washington, there was another part of that policy that said that they would be grievously disabled. And when you look at how that was interpreted, it was someone who was so mentally ill that pretty soon they couldn't even take care of their very basic needs for themselves. They wouldn't eat. They wouldn't be clean. They wouldn't keep themselves, you know, from the weather or whatever. So they were people that really had significant mental disabilities. That was an either or. The court didn't deal with that part of the statute because they dealt with the other side of the or in that statute. It wasn't a statute, it was a policy, 600 and something, right? But I really don't think that's square with what we're dealing with here. We do have a statute here, and what we're looking at, in my view, is more like the first part of the policy in Washington, where you didn't have to have dangerousness, okay? But the court didn't deal with that in Washington because they were looking at the dangerous criteria. Here, we don't have dangerousness, but we do have to have an inability to make decisions for the prisoner to make decisions in his or her own, for his or her own well-being.
And I think that's a great observation to point out that split definition that's present in Harper, because even that, I think if you look at the exact definition of gravely disabled, that's something more. I mean, to me, I read that as that's some type of harm that's flowing from the commitment. Yeah. And so, like I said, I view dangerousness very broadly. And so to me, like in Washington, you know, not only is there that direct dangerousness, which I think of as more of like a physical,
right,
you know, type of harm, but I think that there could be an additional, you know, there may be other definitions of dangerousness that flow. And so I think that's actually an excellent point.
But you see, there was an or. If it was just another form of dangerousness, then the first part would be superfluous. It's got to be something different than dangerousness. And dangerousness has been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court and by this court as danger to oneself or to others. But I agree with you. Mostly we talk about it in terms of a physical kind of dangerousness.
Yes, and I mean, I think that that could also potentially satisfy. Like I said, I think it just provides that additional connection to the individual or person. And I just feel that that's lacking here. I mean, mentally ill and incompetent, I just think that would include everyone. And I don't think that the way it is right now, I just don't think that's enough. I think, like I keep saying, there has to be something more. There has to be something that actually is tying to the facts of the individual.
So the way that we define competency is not enough. Because my understanding of that policy from Washington case, it involved more, it wasn't just finding the person incompetent, this other piece, not the dangerous piece, but the part that Chief Justice Rogenczak is talking about. And in there, if they called it unable to take care of their own needs, or we're talking about some kind of deterioration, but is competency that? Does our competency statute, when you find someone incompetent, are you saying that they can't take care of their own medical needs, that they're not going to feed themselves? I mean, is that the distinction you're making?
That's correct. If you look at the definition of incompetency, it just talks about, it says that because of mental illness, they've had to have explained the advantages and disadvantages. And then it focuses on whether or not they're incapable of expressing or understanding the advantages and disadvantages. And I actually thought the court made a really compelling statement in the Fitzgerald case. I think the court said the mere inability of a defendant to express understanding of medication or make an informed choice is insufficient to override the defendant's liberty interest in avoiding the unwanted injection of medication. And so to me, the fact that somebody may be incompetent doesn't mean that you can also inject. I just don't think that's sufficient enough. And so I had pointed in the brief to that LW case. And my whole point of the LW case was really that just because you've been found incompetent doesn't mean that you're losing the right to avoid the administration of medication. That finding doesn't mean that they can inject medication against your will. And so I think that, you know, I just don't think that incompetent, you can find somebody incompetent and say, because they're incompetent, we can go ahead and we can administer that medication when they have refused.
Can you help
counsel,
me with the... Can you help
I,
me with
I
the...
Counsel, at the outset, I want to indicate that on occasion, I will be standing during oral argument because of some back problems. And with that, by way of preface, I will continue with a question. And that is, okay, you say that dangerousness may not be necessarily the physical, but something less, a more passive. How passive is passive? I look at paragraph 8 of the Court of Appeals opinion, and the general welfare of the prisoner is the standard. What's wrong, if anything, with that? Is that too passive of a standard in terms of what we should be looking at vis-a-vis the administration of this kind of medication?
So, once again, I think just saying like a general welfare, general interest isn't specific enough or individualized to the person. I think that there has to be, like I said before, some type of harm that occurs to the person or that might occur to somebody else or will result from the absence of medication. And so, to me, if it's just general welfare, I don't think that that would be enough to satisfy the meet somebody's interest in avoiding the administration of medication.
Counsel,
go
ahead. Yeah.
So help me out with this, with the idea of incompetency and the decision to reject medication. So if we find that a person is incompetent with respect to the refusal to accept medication, aren't we saying that that person is incapable of making a decision on whether that medicine should or should not be administered? Isn't that what we're saying when we say a person is incompetent in this respect?
That is what the statute says.
So if that's true, so you say, even though they're incompetent in that sense, you have to respect their decision not to accept the medication. But how do those two play together? Because if they're not competent to make the decision, but you're allowing them to make the decision, it seems that that's mutually contradictory.
Well, I just think that there needs, as I keep mentioning, I think that there needs to be some type of harm that's attendant to circumstances.
I know you, that's what you think. What I'm struggling with is this idea that we can say the person is incompetent to make decisions like this, but we're going to respect the decision that they verbalize anyway. Hmm. Right? Why is that?
Well, I think the fact that you're incompetent, like I said, I like the language in the LW case. Just because you're incompetent doesn't mean that you lose the right to refuse the medication or have your wishes honored.
It's not a question of right. It's a question of ability. Mm-hmm. When we say that a person is incompetent in this context, we're saying they don't have the ability to make a rational decision with respect to the medication. So it's not a question of whether they're right to reject it. Mm-hmm. It's whether they have the ability to reject it, isn't mm-hmm. it?
And perhaps, I mean, once again, you know, maybe there needs to be something more in that situation. Maybe there needs to be a guardian ad litem, or maybe there needs to be somebody who's looking into the best interests of the person. I mean, once again, I just think that...
Aren't we getting into policy considerations rather than constitutional requirements?
Yes. I think that, you know, once again, this could be something that would be up to the legislature. I just think that in the absence of, once again, that individualized, that the state or the county has an interest in providing the care and protection to an individual, I think a generalized interest is just not enough, coupled with the incompetency. Right. So I don't think that saves it.
Let's go to a very practical level. So what are they supposed to do with an incarcerated individual who's incompetent, who we've decided cannot make a rational decision with respect to the administration of medication? Are they just supposed to let them sit there? By virtue of being incarcerated, they are in the state's care. And they're supposed to let a person who's not competent to make a decision for themselves with respect to medication just sit there. Is that what they're supposed to do?
Well, I think that if somebody is mentally ill, that just isn't enough, like I said, to administer the medication unless there's some type of dangerousness.
I know. So if it's not just a question of mentally ill, it's a question of being incompetent. Right? Mm-hmm. So if the person is incompetent to make a decision on whether or not to accept medication, is the state supposed to just let that person sit there unmedicated?
I believe if there is no finding or no requirement that that person is going to be harmed by terms of their mental illness, then I think that, yes, you can administer the medication. I think that if there is some finding or indication that that person sitting there because he's not getting the medication is either going to be hurting himself or, you know, hurting others or somehow deteriorating or something bad is going to happen to that person, then I think that's when you medicate. But if the person is, you know, mentally ill, if they're... no harm resulting by the lack of treatment in that case, I just don't think that you can administer the medication.
Right.
I think there needs to be something more.
So what you're suggesting is the operative assumption that we are supposed to make is that a person incompetent to make a decision on medication, we're supposed to assume that he doesn't actually want medication, right? We're just supposed to assume that.
Yes, if the person
why should we indulge that assumption rather than the opposite assumption that he would want to get medication that would make him well?
Well, I mean, as I was alluding towards before, perhaps there would need to be some type of guardian or some other person to make sure then that this is in the best interest.
Right, and that might be a very wise mm-hmm. thing to do, but that's for the legislature to decide. We're just dealing with the constitutional requirements. Mm-hmm. So why are we, as a constitutional matter, to assume that an incompetent person would not want to be medicated?
I just think that in that instance, without that addition, I don't think that the state's interest in wanting to medicate overcomes that person's substantial liberty rights in avoiding the medication.
We don't really know. I mean, he has that right, clearly, no doubt about it. But we don't really know what he wants to do with that right, do we? If he's incompetent, we don't know what he wants.
I think, though, the fact that he's opting to refuse, I mean, as I circle back, just all of the side effects that are attendant in a situation like that. And so I think part of it, you know, if there was a finding of dangerousness for the commitment, you know, then I think you can, the medication statute is the fine on its own. The problem that I have in this case.
Here's what I need to understand your position. I need something that says, this is the assumption that we have to make about an incompetent person. We have to, as a constitutional matter, we must assume that person does not want medication. Where do I get that presumption?
I think that what I am relying on heavily is just going back. To me, this is the Harper case. Incompetency didn't come at all, in my opinion, into the whole Harper analysis. They require, in order to overcome somebody's liberty interest, it's that the person is mentally ill and dangerous. And so I think that, to me, the incompetency just is not a factor that can be taken into consideration.
But Washington v. Harper, Mr. Harper was not incompetent, right?
There was not a determination of competency in that case. And
okay. So if we're talking about competency, then Harper doesn't really instruct us in what to do in that kind of a circumstance. So, again, I need to figure out something that, as a constitutional requirement, says that we must assume that an incompetent person does not want to.
Did CS refuse the medication?
He did.
So he made a choice.
Yeah.
Whether, and I understand the finding of competency, but isn't that where you start from? If he wanted the medication, he could have it, right?
Yes.
And I want to ask another thing. When we talk about mental illness, because there was a reference by one of my colleagues to curing the illness or curing you or making you better, especially with respect to schizophrenia, isn't it true that a bulk of people are going to be medicated and never get better, and it won't change them at all, and it's a very complicated disease?
Yes, that's correct.
So unlike if you needed insulin, let's say, and there was a medical need. So I guess, are you tying this into some, you made reference to what the state would need to overcome this interest, which has been asserted by CS, to not be medicated. He's asserting his right to not have a needle stuck in him and have the side effects and do all of this. To overcome that right, there needs to be some kind of finding on the part of the state more than just that he's not competent. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yes, that is CS's position, that there has to be a essential or overriding interest in order to administer the medication, and that is based on Harper.
What if the medication can be successful, not in curing the mental illness, but in alleviating the symptoms? I read some testimony of Dr. Kashina, who described, according to the state's brief, an incident where CS was absolutely distraught and sobbing about microchips and tracking devices he believed were placed in him during his military service. Does CS and others, do they have a right to receive treatment so that they don't have to live in that sort of mental distress? Is that, I guess what I'm really asking is, without a finding of dangerousness, is it enough to show that these really terrible symptoms of a mental illness can be relieved? Isn't that a benefit to CS and others?
So I think, you know, there could potentially be an argument, right, if somebody is so distressed or upset because of their mental illness that they've refused to eat. I mean, I think that would potentially meet the requirement of dangerousness. And so, I just think that there needs to be something, some additional link, like linking it to the actual person. And so in that example, once again, if there is testimony that CS, because of his mental illness, he's so upset, he's so emotionally distressed that this is somehow causing him not to eat, he ends up losing 100 pounds, then I think you have the dangerousness requirement. And so I'm not asking, you know, for a really complicated definition. I'm just arguing or asserting that I think based on the way the statute is, it's just not enough to say somebody is incompetent, therefore you don't have the right to refuse. I don't think that overcomes, circling back, the state's interest in providing the care or treatment that's too generalized. And I don't dispute either that the state does have an interest in providing care. It's just when you're alleging generally that they have this interest, I don't think that's enough. That's why I think it's just really important to have something more. So you look at that person and can make the determination.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Marianne Miller, and I am Corporation Counsel for Winnebago County, and I represent Winnebago County in this case. This case is about the state's ability to provide CS with the help he needs. This court should hold it is constitutional to medicate and treat non-dangerous inmates who are not competent to accept or refuse psychotropic medication and care under 5161. 5161 is constitutional because it is rationally related to the state's legitimate and compelling interest to provide care and assistance to non-dangerous inmates who are mentally ill and not competent to refuse such medication and treatment. I would submit the standard of review to be applied should be beyond a reasonable doubt, but even if this court were to adopt a different standard, this statute would still be constitutional because under the doctrine of parens patriae, the state has a legitimate and compelling interest in providing care to persons who are unable to care for themselves.
What if CS was not incarcerated?
I'm sorry, Governor.
What if CS was not incarcerated? Would there be any constitutional bar against involuntarily medicating him?
Yes, Your Honor. This, as you know, involves an incarcerated person. So as a result, he does have liberty interests, but those liberty interests are confined. But the key, as far as Winnebago County is concerned, is the fact that he has been found mentally incompetent. After a full panoply of rights, he had an adversarial proceeding. He had a right to counsel. He had a right to an independent medical exam. And it is the county's position that to basically sit by and watch a person who has been adjudged mentally incompetent to languish is not the way to go here.
So according to what Justice Kelly has said, I'm just going to build off that. So basically, if the key is that they're being found mentally incompetent and the way you overcome the substantial interest with parens patriae, under that theory, you could medicate people that are not incarcerated because you could say it is not fair to that person. We have this responsibility as a state to alleviate their symptoms and impose on them medication that causes potential side effects because we're, as the state, going to make the difference. We're going to decide because they're incompetent that they'd rather have the medication than the symptom than the alternative.
But again, the difference is when there is a prison inmate, the state essentially becomes the parent because if the inmate needs assistance, he would have to go to the state to get the assistance.
So this would apply even for someone that hasn't committed a crime? They're not in prison, but they're in a mental institution because they're in a state institution? I mean, where are you drawing this line?
I'm drawing the line when there is someone who is in need of care and they are not able to get that care.
So they're in a hospital and then the hospital has the right to do it? I mean,
no, it is based on the fact that again, there would be a full adversarial proceeding. And this case is just looking at prisoners.
But don't prisoners have a lesser expansive liberty interest? I mean, I read from Washington, says the extent of the prisoner's right under the clause, talking about due process, to avoid unwanted administration of antipsychotic drugs must be defined in the context of the inmate's confinement. So they really limit what they're saying in Washington County to someone who's been convicted of a crime, is incarcerated for that, and now we're looking at an expressed mental illness by that person.
Correct, Your Honor. That is exactly the case. And I would point out, this is, as far as I'm concerned, in some respects, not a Harper case. Because, number one, Harper was concerned or focused on institutional security. We are talking about the well-being of an inmate. And if I could point the court to the actual transcript, and keep in mind, the purpose of Chapter 51 is treatment-focused. The policy is to assure the provision of a full range of treatment and rehabilitation services in the state for all mental disorders. If you look at the transcript specifically, and I know we're talking about, actually, the Disability Rights Center in its brief referenced, this is about a shot for behavioral control and convenience of the staff. First of all, the court should know the Wisconsin Resource Center is a psychiatric treatment facility for inmates who are confined to the Department of Corrections. There are programs specifically geared to help mentally ill. I would refer the court to appendix pages 111 and 113 of the transcript. There are psychiatrists, there are psychologists, there are social workers, there are nurses. There is a holistic approach. And in the appendix on page 109 and 111, Dr. Kachina testified that after all protocols were followed, there were many attempts to get CS to get the help that he needed before going the involuntary medication route. As one of the justices has indicated, CS believed he had a chip implanted in his body by the military. So the WRC said, again on pages 109 and 111, pursuant to Dr. Kachina's testimony, why don't we have an X-ray to see if, in fact, there is a foreign body present? An X-ray was taken. It proved negative. And CS's response was, well, it's made out of a certain metal, and it can't be detected by an X-ray.
Counsel, what if CS was not incompetent? Could you involuntarily medicate?
No.
Why not?
Because he would not have had the full panoply of rights. The problem is that, in this case, CS had the full panoply of rights. He had a probable cause hearing.
Right. That's procedural. Right. So what we're looking for is a substantive constitutional bar against involuntary medication. Is there one if he's incarcerated but competent?
If he is incarcerated, then the bar is the dangerousness piece. But again...
But let's say that he's not dangerous, but he's mentally ill. And you say, well, look, he's in our care. We're parens patriae. Incarcerated, and run involuntarily medicate him. What would be the constitutional bar against that?
The bar would be mental illness and mental competence are not synonymous.
Yeah, I know. But you said that the reason that we can impinge on his decision not was that he's incarcerated.
No. I apologize if... What I want to convey is the reason that we can impinge on his right, in addition to the fact that his liberty rights are confined to a certain extent because he is incarcerated, is because of the mental incompetency component. Our position is that...
Stop right there. So it's the incompetence that allows us to say you can be involuntarily medicated.
No question. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's take away the incarceration then.
I'm sorry.
Let's take away the incarceration. Still mentally incompetent. Can you involuntarily medicate him?
After a full panoply of rights, yes, he could. We could.
For someone who is not incarcerated, don't you need a dangerousness determination as the second element?
There could be. Well, under 5161, as the court knows, there are two prongs. There could be a finding of dangerousness or a finding of incompetence. And 5161, again, as the court knows, applies to prisoners as well as non-prisoners. However, in this brief, we are talking about CS and inmates and not a world beyond inmates, because what has been the fact that CS, again, is an inmate.
To be committed, though, as an inmate, do you need a finding of dangerousness?
No.
But to be committed as a non-inmate, you need a finding of dangerousness?
Yes.
To be administered medication against your will as a citizen who's been committed, where there's the finding of dangerousness, do they need to be determined to be unable to understand the advantages, disadvantages?
Yes, Your Honor.
As an inmate in an institution where you can be committed because you're mentally ill, but there's no finding of dangerousness or determination of dangerousness at all, can you be administered medication because you don't understand the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives to accepting that treatment?
You can be administered medication, correct, if you do not understand, once again, you've had the panoply of rights to protect your interests.
Right, but what's different other than if you're a citizen, you have to meet a dangerousness component, and if you're an inmate, you don't?
The difference is that with an inmate, you're confined, so perhaps it could be implied that there could be dangerousness. But again, under this statute, and I want to point out, they do not require dangerousness.
Well, then what would prohibit the legislature from removing dangerousness from the citizen, too? If you're mentally ill, the state should provide you involuntarily with medication.
Again, that's the legislature's decision, but they opted not to do that. And again, I believe it is critical that they did not put the word dangerousness in this statute.
I know, that's why we're here. We're trying to figure out if it's constitutional. So what's the rational basis for saying if you're mentally ill and not competent to refuse, if you're an inmate, they can medicate you and that's it. If you are a citizen and you're determined to be someone who should be committed because you're mentally ill and dangerous to self or others and meet that standard, you still got to go through the next hoop of the understanding of the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives.
Correct.
So I know this isn't the case today, but it is interesting. I mean, if it's the state's interest to do that for an inmate, why is that different than the state's interest to do that for a citizen?
Because, in my opinion, the state's interest is higher when they are dealing with inmates who cannot care for themselves. Because under the parens patriae doctrine, the state is responsible.
But you could say the same thing about somebody who has not been convicted of a crime but has been committed on an inpatient basis to a state institution. They're still under the care of the state. So I think what we're all asking is, what is it about a person who's been incarcerated, a person who's been convicted of a crime, what is different about that person that justifies the forcible administration of psychotropic medication without a finding of dangerousness?
I believe it would be the interest that they're, while they have a liberty interest, the interest is confined because they are already incarcerated.
So they've been convicted of a crime, so they lose rights that citizens have in this regard with respect to the administration of psychotropic medication.
Yes, Your Honor.
How does your analysis apply to those with an NGI status where they have not been convicted of a crime but still are in an institution?
Again, it would apply in the case of someone who was found mentally incompetent. So in the case of an NGI, there would have to be essentially a finding or a hearing to determine if there was competence or not down the pipe.
But in NGI, there's a guilt determination before you proceed to the second phase of the trial to determine
correct.
If they're not guilty of that crime on that day due to
mental illness.
Mental illness.
So there's guilt.
I want to follow up on the standard employed by the Court of Appeals here, which is a standard of the general welfare of the prisoner. For want of a better legal term, that seems to me to be a bit loosey-goosey, and that it could be applied in almost any situation and is incredibly broad. Can you respond to that to disabuse me of my concern about the breadth of the standard employed by the Court of Appeals?
The Court of Appeals standard was correct. And if we could just point to the actual underlying facts in this case, on page 109 of the appendix, as again I believe Justice Bradley referenced, Dr. Kushina testified CS was, quote, absolutely distraught about microchips implanted in his body. On page 131, Dr. Kushina testified that CS was referred to the WRC in 2007 because he had a suicide attempt where he bit his wrist trying to cut his vein, and he said it was because of the voices he heard.
Counsel, if I may.
Yes.
You're pointing to these specific facts of this case, which may or may not be considered egregious and some kind of a continuum. But I'm talking about a general standard that could have facts much more benign than we have here. The standard, the legal standard, is the general welfare of the prisoner. And that legal standard seems to me to be both amorphous and incredibly broad.
And, Your Honor, I would say that it is not incredibly broad because...
How about just broad? Okay. I'm sorry. Continue.
But we have to look at the world in which we are living. And in these situations, there are, as I said, an army of psychiatrists and psychologists looking at these matters. So as opposed to stepping into another professional's viewpoint of what is able to basically be required, I believe that we have to look at what the various medical doctors and professionals looked at. So I am confident that the Court of Appeals standard is appropriate, and I don't think it could be broad, but I believe it could be applied, and I think it was applied properly in this case.
Counsel, can you tell me what we should do with In Re Commitment of Dennis H.? So there we said that the state has a legitimate interest under its parens patriae powers in providing care to its citizens who are unable to care for themselves. But we also said the state's legitimate interest ceases to exist if those sought to be confined are not mentally ill or if they do not pose some danger to themselves or others. So it seems that we were tying the parens patriae doctrine to dangerousness in that case. Is that not so here? How would you distinguish that?
I would distinguish Dennis H. because Dennis H. did not involve an inmate. I would also note that...
hang on just a second there. So, but it was still discussing the parens patriae doctrine, which is what you're relying on, right?
Yes.
You're engaging the doctrine because he's an inmate.
Yes.
But we still seem to tie the doctrine to dangerousness. That was the state's legitimate interest in exercising the parens patriae power over the individual, was dangerousness. And if there's no dangerousness, then the state's legitimate interest disappears. So why would that not be the case here?
Because we are also looking at a situation of basically restoring, and I would point to Wood, someone to a relatively even keel, to
But you could say that about a non-incarcerated person, too, couldn't you?
You could.
Okay.
Yes, you could.
But
we've
already agreed that constitutionally the state doesn't have a sufficient interest in an unincarcerated person.
Correct.
To make that decision on medication for them. So it looks like Dennis H. is telling us that the incarceration part isn't a qualifying factor for you.
Dennis H. talks about, as the court knows, There are a number of interests. One is ultimately reducing the amount of time spent in an institutional setting because you're giving the person the help he needs or she needs. They talk about preventing catastrophic harm. The court talks about restoring a patient to a relatively even keel. And also in Dennis H., as this court would recall, the court stated prophylactic intervention does not violate substantive due process. The practicality of this situation is if we have someone who is diagnosed as schizophrenic, he has not been found dangerous. He has a belief that his food is being poisoned. He refuses to eat. His organs fail. He dies. What if we had a psychotic person who has delusions, not dangerous. He believes people are going to get him. He refuses to go out of the cell, even though there's a requirement that inmates have to go out of the cell daily to be counted. What happens to that person? Does he get thrown in segregation?
It's harm to self or others. So what you're doing is making her case. I mean, if that's the only person that's getting involuntarily medicated, then you've just made her case. You're really reading that language into the statute.
No.
I mean, there are a lot of mentally ill people in prison. They don't all deserve to be involuntarily medicated.
Absolutely. The only people
who... So just trust the government not to do it?
No. The only people who can be medicated, Justice Ziegler, as far as we're concerned, are those who are found mentally incompetent.
Right, but that takes a doctor's report. I mean, in this report with this particular individual, he explained all sorts of reasons why he doesn't like this medication and doesn't want to take it. That routinely happens in commitments of citizens and commitments of inmates, and sometimes that's reasonable and sometimes it isn't. But what we have here is basically an examining doctor saying not competent to refuse because I think he needs these, which might be reasonable. But what's the protection?
The protection is that this person would have a right to a trial. This person would have legal counsel. This person would have a right to have an independent medical examination. So there are protections.
Yeah, but so long as the state tells you you need it, how do you defend against that if you don't have to prove that somehow, I mean, you might benefit from it, but what one person thinks is beneficial, another person, the person who has to take it, may think it's not. Is it just convenient for the state? Is that a good enough reason? Oh, we like him when he's calm. We like him when he doesn't talk as much. We want to medicate this person because that's for the state's benefit?
It's not convenience. It's not convenience. It's the obligation under Parents Patriae to take care of those people who are not able to take care of themselves after they have been adjudicated incompetent.
I guess I've just had too many cases where one person's definition of take care is not the other side's, and that's when you have it, right? And then the court has to determine, knowing a number of things, whether or not the statute's met. So here, when you don't have the additional safeguard of dangerousness or harm or something like that, that will be the result if the person doesn't take the meds, what's the safeguard? What's the stop?
Again, it would be based on all of the rights that this inmate would have before we get to the portion of the map where he is found incompetent.
Yeah, but for any other citizen, part of all those things that need to be proven would be the dangerousness, the harm to self or others, among other things, and mental illness. But for the inmate, so long as you're mentally ill, you just fast forward to whether somebody decides they don't know what they're doing when they're picking, and they're not competent, really, is the phrase. Competent to understand the advantages, disadvantages of, and alternatives to treatment. But here, no.
What would happen if we had a situation where there was a dangerousness requirement imposed? So you would have one inmate who perhaps he was found dangerousness and there would be, he would be able to get treatment. But then let's say we had the case of another inmate where dangerousness was not found, where the behavior had not ripened into dangerousness, would that person then basically sit idly by, languishing, and not get the assistance he needed?
Well, when you say languishing, and some of those examples you've given, and really looking at the standard the way Justice Ann Walsh Bradley was framing it, and also this is building off of Justice Ziegler's questions, looking at the standard, why does it need to be that broad? What I hear you saying is this case doesn't fit that. This was a case where he was suffering. There are cases where people refuse to eat. No, we're not going to let them die in their cell when they refuse to eat. But isn't that what the state is saying? Do we need to frame this as just parens patriae, we get to take care of you? Or is it we get to take care of you, we get to step in and do that, not just where you're not competent to pick whether you want a medication or not, but because where there's some kind of harm, and maybe it's not dangerousness to the level that got you there, but something, some kind of harm that's going to happen to you or to others, or where we get to then step in. Doesn't the Constitution require that? That's the question.
I do not believe the Constitution requires it. I believe the Constitution requires the state to step in when there is a mental incompetence finding. I do not believe there needs, and the statute obviously doesn't reference dangerousness, and I don't believe that should be added to this.
Well, doesn't the state then have a legitimate interest to step in for anyone who's mentally ill and help them? You don't need to determine whether a citizen is dangerous. They should just take that out there, because we should be helping everybody who's mentally ill and medicating them against their will, regardless of whether they cause harm to themselves or others.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, we should be helping all the mentally ill. I'm not talking about involuntarily medicating everybody. But given the state of the union today, I think, as we all know, mental illness is a significant factor, and those people need assistance, but certainly not involuntarily medicated. And again, this is not just about giving someone a shot.
Why not? That's really the question. Why not? What's the difference between the citizen and what's the state's interest? It's so different between a citizen and a cellmate, other than they happen to be in the state prison system.
Again, I go back to the parens patriae doctrine. The fact that we, the state, is responsible for providing care to someone who has been adjudged not able to be competent and to get the care that he needs.
Counsel, I'm going to shift your focus a little bit and drawing you back to Washington. And one of the things that the court focused on, and I read from Washington, we held that the proper standard for determining the validity of a prison regulation claimed to infringe on an inmate's constitutional right is to ask whether the regulation is reasonably related to a legitimate penological interest. What's the penological interest here?
Taking care of the prisoner, the entire environment. That's the penological interest, Your Honor.
Okay, so you come back to the same thing, parens patriae is your answer.
Yes, Your Honor. And again,
it sounds to me that it's more than parens patriae, that it's the making sure that the environment isn't disrupted. It isn't just, from your answer, taking care of the inmate, but also a larger interest in advancing the efficacy of the penal system.
You could add that as well, but I would say the paramount purpose would be, again, to taking care of the inmate, Your Honor.
Counsel, just a question on it's like looking back at like CS1 and kind of what we did there. When someone is in prison is committed, I understand different circumstances. What are they required to do? What kind of treatment are they required to get, if any, when they are committed?
It would obviously, again, and this is sort of alluding to the fact that this is not just a shot. Based on what the medical practitioners believe, there could be therapy. Actually, at the WRC, there are recreational programs. There is spiritual counseling. There's exercise. There is therapy. So it's not just let's give someone a shot. I talked, I think, about earlier the holistic approach, the fact that there are numerous professionals involved to help people get the care.
And they can refuse that, though, right? You can't make someone do talk therapy. I mean, you can sit them in front of you and you can say, let's do this, but if they refuse to talk, you can't do anything to them.
You're absolutely right.
And there are people that go to these institutions and refuse to participate in treatment, even knowing that they may never get out. They might be competent. They might know that if they don't participate, they're not going to get out, and they are not going to participate, and that's their right.
Yes, Your Honor. I would point out, too, just so the court realizes, as Dr. Kushina testified, there are 400 inmates at the WRC, but less than 25% are under an involuntary commitment order. Actually, as of January 2020, 65 are on a commitment order.
So that's 16%. Involuntary medication order or involuntarily?
An involuntary commitment.
Okay.
And in terms of the medication order, I was told that of the 65 on the commitment order, there were all but three who were not on an involuntary medication order.
All but three who were not. So the rest of them are.
So right. So 62 out of 65.
Are involuntarily medicated.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So Justice Hagendorn actually kind of was getting towards where I wanted to start. And I wanted to start just by being clear that there's been a lot of discussion about somebody who's mentally ill just languishing in prison. To be clear, if you're mentally ill under our statutory standard, that gets you the commitment. And what that means, the way I read the statutes, is that means that you're sent to a state treatment facility. So you'll have people there who are, you know, specialized or staff handling with mental illness. I mean, there's been a discussion that'll be additional programming. And so, you know, the person isn't just in that respect languishing in prison. We can commit right now under AR without any type of finding of dangerousness. It's just where I'm drawing the line or where I see the line drawn is when it comes not only committing but then also medicating and intruding on that person's liberty interests. And so as a result, I think that because the medication is so intrusive, I think there are greater protections that are maybe needed in the prisoner context than in the actual civil commitment context. And so
so we can involuntarily commit prisoners without a finding of dangerousness, but we can't involuntarily medicate them without a finding of dangerousness. You would make that distinction?
Yes, I am not challenging the original CS decision. And I think to some extent that does make sense because, once again, you know, in the prison context, medicating them, injecting them with a medication, I mean, that is a greater liberty interest than perhaps confining. So I think that distinction can, in fact, be drawn. The second point I wanted to make, I agree with the court that it's concerning the slippery slope that you can just medicate somebody based on a finding of incompetence. As I keep saying, I think that there needs to just be something more connecting it. I know the state had, or the county had made a comment about care. Well, I think if care is in fact needed, if treatment's needed because that person's going to suffer, then you have, you know, that satisfies the dangerousness requirement. So I'm not at all advocating that, like, there's no way to treat somebody who's mentally ill and in prison. It's just that I think that there's something more that's needed, some individualized finding that...
You mentioned that individualized piece, and that part I guess I'm not maybe totally understanding. I mean, when they're found incompetent, there's an individualized determination of their ability to make that choice. So the only people who are subject to an involuntary medication order are people who there's been an individualized finding there, right? Or by individualized, are you just referring to, maybe you can explain that a little bit.
I'm referring more to that there needs to be some harm that's going to result. If a person's not medicated, then this person, there's going to be some harm. And so that's why I mean there needs to be a link to the person. It's not enough just to have a general a general interest in caring and providing treatment. Because if that person is going, if there's going to be some harm that results to that person or somebody else or some type of additional deterioration, then I think the dangerousness requirement. And so I would just ask that the court find that the way the statutes are currently written, that the way the medication statute is, that it's simply unconstitutional. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you both for very, very interesting arguments, and your briefs were very helpful. We are going to take a brief adjournment for time to let some of the people leave, other people come in.